Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back, the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And you know what? I just, this is probably my biggest boxer I've ever had on the program, because I've really not had many boxers, but I consider him one of my all-time favorites. And we're talking off air about boxing and how in the 80s, how popular it was. Growing up, I remember watching boxing and wrestling. Both sports were more mainstream in certain ways, and you could, the characters were fantastic. It was so interesting. So to have this guest on the program and to know that he's gone back to his hometown that's near Pittsburgh, I love it. So I want to welcome to the program Ray Boom Boom Mancini, former WBA lightweight champion, International Boxing Hall of Fame. Ray, thanks for calling. How are you?
Oh, yeah, good, buddy, good. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Absolutely, Ray. And I think growing up in Youngstown, did you ever think you were going to be this big of a boxer when you first started? For sure.
I mean, no, I don't think anybody goes into thinking, I want to be a star. All I wanted to be was champion. Now, once you win a world championship, you don't know. I didn't at that time. Or understand the magnitude of what that means. But once you become world champion, It's exactly that. You know, in the amateurs here, the local amateurs in Youngstown, I gotten some acclaim, you know, and I became a popular amateur fighter here in the area. And my whole dream is to, you know, turn pro, and I wanted to move to New York like my father did and win the world title for him. But, you know, so I went to New York in September of 1979 and, you know, living the dream and training, and I worked out and training at the Times Square gym, right. living on my trainer's couch at first, and then once I started making a little bit of money and I could afford my own apartment, I got my own apartment. But the thing is, you know, it's like actors, the starving actor. You know, you hear about the starving actor all the time, so he hits and pick. Right. Well, it's kind of like worlds for me as a fighter, the fighting us. Fighting, living from fight to fight, paying my bills, but I wasn't making no big money or anything like that. But you have a dream and a goal, and you do whatever it takes to get there. And then I got a shot on USA Cable, USA Network, which was only regional at the time. I don't think it was national. And that was March 12th of 1981.
Okay.
And I knocked opponent out in the second round, and as Don Dunphy said, it was an auspicious debut. So I made a big mark on my first network debut. I made a sensational knockout. That fight got me a fight the following month, April. I think it was April 2nd, 1981, on ESPN, and I was a co-feature. The main event was Vito Interfermo. It was his first comeback fight after he fought Marvin Hagler. And I was the semifinal. And I fought a guy named Al Ford. Al Ford was from Canada, a lightweight contender at one time, who was known for going the distance. He didn't get knocked out, never knocked out or stopped. So I said, well, I'm going to knock him out. You know, very trick, very slick guy. And I dropped him in the fourth round, and he got up, and he just schooled me after that. I mean, I beat him. I was, my youth and enthusiasm and right. The pressure put on was too much. But he put me to school. He taught me so much, you know, and I went the distance. And because I was impressive in that fight, the networks and CBS is talking about getting back into the boxing world, and they want to showcase the lightweights. Oh, man, I hit the juggernaut. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Because they're in the other division and want to be lightweight. So I get my first network television fight, May 16th of 1981, and because what they're doing a lightweight tournament. So the top 10 guys, after I beat Al Ford, it got me into the top 10. I was number 10 in the world, and they were going to showcase a tournament showcasing the top 10. And my first fight is against the number 6 contender, Jorge Morales, from Las Vegas, via Puerto Rico. And big puncher, nobody wanted to fight the guy. We took the fight because I like the guys who are going to stand in front of me, because we felt that I was going to be the stronger lightweight, you know, bigger puncher. And so May 16th of 81, for the North American. He's a North American champion, and I fight him in upstate New York and at the Concord Hotel, and I stopped him in the ninth round. Well, that made me a star. I made me a TV star. You know, and people understand that. I didn't even understand that at that time. But the power of television.
Right.
I was exposed to over 60 million people domestically, over 100 million people worldwide have the capability of getting, you know, network television.
Exactly.
Now, they talk about people doing pay-per-view. Pay-per-view has 30 million homes capable. If you get a 2% buy rate, which they consider a success, that's only 500,000 people. So the visibility factor is less. But, you know, being on network television exposed me to, you know, 10 million people at one time. So it was incredible.
The casual fans, right? You had the casual fans. I wasn't like one that, you know, knew the whole boxing, how we judge scores. You had the charisma, and you were the days before even, I guess, the WWF got to the point where it got in its level, because people love people with charisma. People love people that were showmen. In those days in boxing, there were a lot of them, and you were one of them for sure. And that's what sells, and that's what gets you the opportunity to get the bigger fights, right?
Absolutely. You know, you got to be, first of all, I had a fan-friendly style. That's what they wanted to see. And along with, you know, myself, but along with Victor Camacho, along with Aaron Pryor, you know, that made Ray Leonard, Tommy Hearns.
Yes.
You know, because before that, ABC was the only network that was showing fights. And they did it one a quarter, so it was like four fights a year. Here, it was on every month, and it became twice a month because it was so popular. So boxing sort of came into the mainstream, the networks, but to the mainstream. And so then you also, people had, you know, I had a story. I wanted to win the world title for my father. So people bought, you know, jumped, you know, hooked onto that. And, you know, and I think that was it. Again, having a good story, being fan-friendly style, that's what, you know, gave me the opportunity to become a boxing star, so to speak. And then from there, then you cross over, because a lot of our sports stars cross over to other culture, you know, it's the entertainment culture. It's just become part of the culture of America. And fortunately, I was fortunate to be one of those people who was able to do that. And so I'm very, very blessed that you know, again, the networks wanted to showcase the fights, and they wanted to showcase the lightweights.
So it's interesting you brought up life after boxing, because of your character and because millions of people all over the world knew who you were, that opportunity led to opportunities after the sport's over. And you think about, when you talk about all the names in boxing in the 70s and 80s, and the sad thing about it is we can't talk about that today. And, you know, and I think that if you look at, even Tyson was probably the last to really, you know, really people talked about boxers. And so you had that name, you had that look. So what happened to you after boxing? Did you know what you were going to do for sure?
No. I only wanted to be a fighter. You know, that's all I wanted to do. No, but I also knew this, that it was a short-term career. I knew it was, my style of fighting was not made for a long career. I was smart enough to understand that. And I also knew there's other things in life I wanted to pursue. I just didn't know what exactly. But the wonderful thing about boxing or any sport, I was able to parlay whatever I accomplished there into another career. I was, from 1983 on, I was starting to be represented by the William Morris Agency. William Morris was the biggest talent agency in the country. And I was represented for, you know, personal appearances, endorsements. And I was getting opportunities to do, cameos in different TV shows and movies. But I was never able to take advantage of it because I was in training camp all the time. So in 1984, Sylvester Stallone's company approached us about doing my life, a movie about my life for TV. I was, you know, I was flattered. My agent at the time pushed for me to read for myself. Agent pushed for me to audition by myself. So I was very flattered by that, and I didn't know But I didn't know at the time, anything about acting. But I just knew, being in front of the camera, and you know, the camera don't punch back. You know,
right.
The worst thing happens is take two. So So, I mean, well, you know, I did it. And they said, wait a minute, you could act. You could really do this. I did it again. And they said, wow, you know, you could act. I said, I'm not acting. I lived this, you know. But they offered me the role. They offered me the role to play myself in a TV movie. And I wasn't able to do it because I was training for my last fight against the rematch against Livingstone Bramble at that time.
Okay.
And so I just, but it, I got hooked. I said, man, the camera don't, the worst thing that happens is take two, camera don't punch back. And I said, I lost the love for the fight game. And I was looking for something else. So I told my agent, I want to pursue this. I want a chance to do it. And he said, well, if you're really serious, you got to come, you know, you got to move out. You got to come to L.A. I said, well, I figured that's not a good idea, you know, when I moved to New York, when I wanted to be a fighter. And then if you're going to be in the entertainment business, you've got to go to L.A. Because, you know, the old saying, if you're going to go fishing, you got to go to the water.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so I did. I moved out there in June of 1985, and I was out there for 30 years. I just moved back to Youngstown this past November. And all it means is I'm going to be based here now. It's like after I won the title, and I lived in New York. After I won the title, I didn't have to be in New York anymore, live in New York. I was based in Youngstown, lived in Youngstown, and I was traveling from Youngstown, you know, traveling, training camp, or wherever I had to go. Same thing with business. I'm based here now. But for me, over the last 10 to 12 years, people I've been dealing with for independent financing and things like that are all from New York and Washington, D.C. So it made sense to come back. I was waiting for my youngest to go off to college. And that's why I came back. So I'm back now. I'm back in the Youngstown area, and I'll be commuting back to California, wherever I got to go from here.
So, Ray, what parts did you have in acting? Because I don't know. And for our listeners out there,
I've done 18 films. I've done off-Broadway stage, a lot of TV. I did a remake of Body and Soul, the old John Garfield film, greatest boxing movie ever made. It was 1948, John Garfield Ball. I produced it for MGM. In 1998, it came out, 1998, so Body and Soul. I did Turn of Faith, a film we shot here in Youngstown in 2000. It's based on a true story. I played a cop, and a friend of mine who was a cop was based after one of his cases. I've done Red Belt for Dave Mamet. Red Belt, that, you know, a couple of years ago, worldwide distribution. I did a movie in 1992 that is a cult classic. Everywhere I go, people who've seen the movie say, that's the funniest movie I ever saw. It didn't get the distribution that it should have. I'm going to tell you the cast in a minute. And you know that. But now it's been re-released on Blu-ray and DVD. It's called The Search for One-Eyed Jimmy. If you get it, trust me, it's the finest movie you'll see. And it was me, Nick Turturro, Holt McCallany, and Mike Bottoluco. We played four guys going around the neighborhood looking for our friend One-Eyed Jimmy, who disappeared. But here's the cast of characters we come across. John Turturro is a character called Disco Bean. He's back in the 70s. He was rehearsing for Quiz Show at that time. He came to give us a couple of days. Sam Jackson.
Oh my!
Plays a character from who's stuck in a time warp. He thinks he's in Vietnam still. He was doing shooting Jurassic Park. He flew back to give us a weekend. Steve Buscemi is a co-star. Steve Buscemi had just won Sundance Award for the best upcoming actor. He did a movie called In the Soup. That won Sundance.
Okay.
It was his first film after that. Jennifer Bills came in and gave us a weekend. She was, you know, Jennifer Bills from Flashdance.
Yes.
Now, here's a guy who played One-Eyed Jimmy. He had one scene. The end of the movie, he stole the movie. And now a major, you know, star, Sam Rockwell.
Sam Rockwell,
you know, Confessions of a Confused Mind, whatever he did, but he played Chuck Barris.
Yes.
Also, The Way, Way Back. He did a movie couple years, last year. It was Way, Way Back. I mean, he came in and gave us one scene and became a major star. So this is a cast we did. We shot all us for less than $100,000. That cast right there now would be close to a $50, $60 million movie with just that cast alone.
Wow.
So that
was a good experience. But you basically were a working actor, and you still are a working actor, and you produce now as well. But But your philanthropic work in Youngstown, can you tell us a little bit about that?
The one thing I'm proud of, I just got back, and one of the things I wanted to do for a long time, I wanted to create my own foundation, charitable foundation, because I've seen some of what the people do, and it's wonderful. And I just didn't know how to go about it. I've been wanting to do this for years. So finally I come back, and a friend of mine who's been working with me for years, she said, you know, let me look into it. And she checked that and looked into it and came out and said, Ray, well, we got the articles, the corporation, and what's your mission statement? They want to know what your mission statement is. I said, my mission statement is simply this. I want to help those in the Youngstown area. I want to keep it local. I want to help those here that can't help themselves, those who don't get government financing. To me, that's the most important. That's those who need assistance of corporate or individuals in the area. So right now we have on our part of our charitable foundation is the Purple Cats, which this gentleman helps young kids who have physical and psychological problems.
Okay.
And he gives them jobs. They have an actual job. They go on and they work, and it's wonderful. I've been on the radio show. They have a radio show I've done. We're difference makers. My friend and former teacher, one of my dear friends, father of Tim O'Neill, as a difference makers, where we help, you know, with food and clothing for the poor. And, of course, the Hope House. Hope House here in Youngstown does exactly that. It's fractured families hope. It's about reuniting families as opposed to separating families. So, it's you know, they have to have a safe house to go to for the parents to work it out so the kids are in a safe environment. And they get no government assistance again. So these are the type of people we're trying to help out.
That's great.
And now, of course... Yeah, in the St. Paul Mission downtown Youngstown, they do a wonderful job handing out food to the homeless and the poor on a daily basis. They don't get government financing. They get assistance from local people. So I'm going to be helping them out. So these are the type of things we want to do. I mean, St. Vincent de Paul.
Yes, that's so great.
They're wonderful. So anyhow, these are organizations. This is what I've done since I've come home, and this is what I'm looking to do.
That's fantastic.
Along with,
Yeah,
along with creating a film studio in downtown Youngstown.
That's where that's the big thing, another big project. Everything's big for Ray Boom Boom Mancini, who we're talking to today. So basically, you're building a film studio in downtown Youngstown for what reason, Ray? Tell us.
To try to make Youngstown a destination point for production. Look, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, we can give you everything Cleveland and Pittsburgh does, but at a better price. Now, the fact of the matter is, will major studios come to Youngstown? Probably not. Because why? You know, they look for the major cities. Because when you have a cast and crew, you know, top-notch cast and crew, they need entertainment value, four-star hotels. We don't have that. Pittsburgh and Cleveland do. But for independent films, we're right on. I'm perfect. Because independent films are looking for places that can give them a better price for locations. For you know, I don't need permits in town. I get buildings for a dollar or for free. You know, the people here in Youngstown treating me well. They've been so wonderful to me. They've been a big part of my success. That whatever I'm trying to do here, they're willing to give me every opportunity to do it and succeed. So we're trying to lure companies to come here. I'll give you everything Cleveland Pittsburgh does, except at a much better price. And you have to understand, downtown Youngstown, downtown Brooklyn, Lower East Side in New York, it's South Street in Philadelphia, it's the North End in Boston. Yet 10 minutes into our suburbs, we have the rolling hills of Nebraska, where the flatlands of New Mexico, the green pastures of Washington State. Because why? We're in the business of illusion. That's entertainment, movie making, it's the business of illusion.
Yes.
We come to Youngstown and we create delusions for you.
That's great. And you also have a film project you're working on. Can you talk about that at all? Are you able to talk about
it? Yes.
Go ahead.
Right now, it's a movie called Monkey's Nest. And it's four storylines. One, we have a father, a single father whose wife is deceased, raising a teenage daughter, 17 years old, senior in high school. It's right before she's trying to break out on her own. She doesn't want to follow her father's rules. He's trying to keep her protected and you know, to keep her in a world from a world that he infiltrates. He is connected, so we have the wise guy's storyline. So we have the daughter, father and daughter storyline that's commercially viable, always sells. We have the wise guy storyline that's commercially viable, always sells. Or we have the Romeo and Juliet storyline that always sells. But now, the biggest point that Kid makes contemporary is that it takes place in a world of EDM. EDM is electronic dance music. Right now, electronic dance music is the number one genre worldwide, all over the world.
Oh, wow.
Electronic dance music. You know, my daughter goes to Ibiza. She's gone there for the last 3 years for the big dance carnival. They have a carnival in Ibiza. They come from all over the world to go there. In Vegas, they have they call it the, you know, EDM circus, and they have rides, and it's a circus. It literally is a circus, and they have while the EDM plays. And you know, so right now the kids, you know, the DJs in the world of EDM are becoming as famous as the artists. So it's an electric type of film. I'm very iconic right now. I'm excited about it. But it's a story of a single father raising a daughter, trying to keep her from the world that he infiltrates. She
yes.
comes, she meets a young man that's in that world, starts a love affair with him. Father is trying to keep her from that.
Yes.
And, you know, it's exciting. It's exciting. And Youngstown is perfect for it.
Do you have a part in this movie, Ray?
I have a part, yes. I have a part in the movie. And but we also have, right now, we have Mickey Rourke, we have John Leguizamo, we have Max Playing, and Russell Peters all attached to be in it. Now, we're looking now, finishing up our financing to close the deal, so I can close the deal with these guys. But those are the guys, they're all in it, they all want to be in it. So now we've got to make sure we close the deal before we get another offer to go off somewhere else. Independent film is always, you know, you're always working on a high wire.
Yes.
You know, make deals, so.
So you're trying to raise the money. You're trying to raise money. Then once you have the money, you have to make sure you retain the actors.
You got it. But of course, see, first of all, we have half the money, and we got people that want to come in. But you got to be able to make pay or play offer, actors. You got to make a pay or play offer so they don't go off. But see, you have to say, I've called on these people are all friends of mine or my producing partners. We call on markers. They all want to do it. They love the concept. They love the script. And so now we just got to, you know, and we should have that money solidified the rest of the budget within the next couple of weeks. So we're looking to start early April. We start shooting here in Youngstown. Early May.
Early May. Well, you're going to have to reach out to me if you want to promote some of this film and bring on some of the actors. I definitely will have you on in that actor for sure. We can.
I appreciate it.
So we'll stay in touch for sure. And it's interesting. I think it's great that you are going to give actors, especially in the Pittsburgh, Cleveland area, the opportunity to work more. Because again, because it's happening. But then I heard some of the taxes of tax incentives in Pittsburgh have disappeared. Right. So this is a perfect time for you to do this, Ray, for sure.
You know, it is, and people understand there's a lot of talent in the area. And, you know,
there's
a lot of people, from Cleveland to Pittsburgh and Youngstown, all out of California. What we're trying to do is bring it back to them where they don't have to leave town. And the business has changed constantly. Now, digital download has changed the game. It's changed the game.
Yeah.
That's Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. So you could do things from here. You don't have to be on the, you know, you could do locations right here. Like I said, it's the business of illusion. If people understood that, they're going to do very well. And a lot of actors, now, I haven't been seen. I know actors that haven't seen a casting agent in years. What you do, you film yourself and you send it in. It's all digital download now. So that's the game. And Youngstown is, and the area is everything to offer. I'm trying to make this for Chinichita, which is where Dino houses his studios now. But it starts, Federico Fellini. They did all his movies there in the 40s, 50s. Chinichita is right outside of Rome. And they come from all over Europe to film a Chinichita. Why? Because it has all the landscaping of everything it could be. And they create delusion. They come from all over the world. They come from all over Europe to film there and make it whatever they want to make.
Well,
you know, make it whatever city. So it's great. So that's what I'm trying to do with Youngstown.
You got a lot of great ideas, Ray. Where's the best place we can find information on you? So our listeners that have been a huge fan of yours and not heard from you in a while, meaning because out in Hollywood, you're busy doing so much stuff. Now you're out close, especially in the local area, but all over the world now, people can know where's the best place to find you, Ray.
Well, you can find me. Hit me up on my Facebook at Ray Boom Boom Mancini. Ray Boom Mancini. You go to my website. It's just RayBoomBoomMancini.com. And then you know, there's a lot of attachments. You know, and that's the best way. RayBoomBoomMancini.com. or Facebook. That's the best way.
Well,
or you can also I'm on Twitter. I'm at Real Boom Boom. Real Boom Boom is on Twitter. So, I mean, there's ways to hit me up. It will get to me. And when it comes out, there'll be a big announcement in the tri-state area, and people will know. You know, people will hear about it because we're looking. There's a lot of talented people in the Pittsburgh area. I'd love to get all the local people.
All right, you reach out to me and let me know, and we'll kind of promote some of the actors and the film once it's ready to be released and stuff. And I'm here for you. Okay, Ray.
Thank you. I'm very kind to you. Thank you so much. I'm very kind to you.
All right, take care, Ray. Good talking to you, man. All right, see ya.
Same here.
Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to the Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google+, Neil Haley. And it's interesting, we get former Steelers, but also I have more than just when I think former Steeler with this guy. Because listeners out there might not know, I'm a huge Colorado Buffalo fan, and the teams that he played for were my favorite Colorado teams of all time because I used to live in Denver. So I'm a huge Bronco fan and Colorado Buffalo fan and Denver Nugget fan. So I'm excited to welcome the program former Pro Bowler, Super Steeler, in definitely my opinion, Chad Brown. Chad, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And I want to just jump right into the days when we were talking off air about going to the University of Colorado and how, you know, the team was mediocre at best, but you knew something special was going to happen with this team, didn't you?
I did. You know, growing up in Southern California, obviously I played football out there, and I knew who the players were who were very good the years before me, and Colorado came to California and had some success recruiting those guys, and I kind of knew that Coach McCartney was building something special out there in Colorado. So as difficult as it was for me to leave the States, to know I was going to be a part of building something special out there in Colorado, which is what we eventually did, won a national championship, 4 consecutive Big A titles during my time there. That was the reason why I left California, because I wanted to, you know, be a part of building. So not go to some school that had this incredible track record of success, but go to a school where I could build something and be remembered as a special class of guys who came in, and that's what we were able to accomplish in Colorado.
Oh, you definitely were. And thinking about the story and thinking about the amazing story of the first year where Colorado really came on the map and you guys were rolling after that, winning, and the sadness of that year and the whole recruiting of LA players and stuff. Tell us that feeling, especially when you started winning, how it was, and then also the national stories that started happening and Colorado finally on the map. For sure.
It was, a very interesting time. You know, our coach, his daughter, you know, ends up being pregnant by one of the players who later, you know, passes away from cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was, such interesting dynamics going on. But I give our coaches a lot of credit. They're able to keep us focused on what was going on the field. The pass in the South was something, that as a young guy, I think it was kind of a galvanizing thing for us, kind of coming together. And, you know, everybody talks about football teams being families, but we have something like that that happens to one of your brothers. It kind of pulls you together as a family, pulls you tighter together. And we were able to use that incredibly, sad, tragic thing to, pull ourselves together, become a, more cohesive team. And, like I said, we went out there and were able to get it done. So very fascinating time at the University of Colorado, without a doubt, but a very successful time on the football field.
Do you think that puts you guys on the map just because of the story of Coach McCartney and his daughter and the passing of Sal, meaning nationally Colorado went on the map, even though, PR at that time was a lot different, but it was just became this story, and the story throughout the year that people started rooting for Colorado that didn't even know about Colorado at all, for sure.
Well, there were a couple of things. There was the Sports Illustrated article that came out, I think it was my freshman year, kind of relaying a lot of the off-the-field issues that, you know, players had in Boulder. And, you know, let's face it, Boulder wasn't really ready to, you know, have all these players from around the country come into it. And so it was also, you know, a growing up period for the program, but also a kind of growing up period for Boulder to deal with some of its, you know, maybe racial issues in the past. So, again, a very, you know, fascinating time. And for the public, as you're talking about, and people beginning to recognize the Colorado football program, you know, you hear, you read a Sports Illustrated article, then you hear about the quarterback with cancer, then, you know, again, the head coach's daughter's having that quarterback's child. Then we go out, you know, we beat Oklahoma and Nebraska. So that, you know, that was the reason, that time frame was the reason why folks began to recognize and hear about the University of Colorado and, you know, the program we were putting together out there.
Your freshman year, you were hoping that we win that national championship, didn't you, Chad? That was such a special story year. You're like, you guys are so close for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how it's tends to repeat itself over and over and over again, and that, you know, teams that are beginning to, you know, move up in the ranking, so to speak, regardless of the sport, regardless of the level of sport, sometimes they need to get to that stage or knock on the door a few times before they're actually able to go out there and get the win done. So that 1989 season, which we were undefeated, you know, we lost Notre Dame in the Orange Bowl. But once we got into the Orange Bowl and was playing a team like Notre Dame, you know, it became clear that they were at a different level than what we were as far as, you know, mental toughness and makeup and that big game experience. We were so new to that stage, we weren't really able to go out there and get it done as well as they were. And, you know, the next year we came back, so we beat Notre Dame the next year in the 1990 Orange Bowl and got the national championship. But, you know, it's funny because both teams very talented, but one team just a much more mentally tougher, willing to lay it on the line team than the team before, which thought, you know, we were good, and we were undefeated, but we weren't toughened up as you needed to be to win a national championship.
So the second year you win the national championship, and you had more of a role in your sophomore year, right, than your freshman year with the team.
Yeah, I had a couple of starts my freshman year, about half the season. My sophomore season, I was a full-time starter and really played well in that 1990 championship game. I think I led the team in tackles, had a couple of pass breakups, caused the fumble, which we recovered, and then that fumble gave our offense really good field position. We went down and scored the game-winning touchdown on that drive based on my caused fumble. And the fumble I caused was against my eventual teammate in Seattle, Ricky Waters, and a guy who actually ended up being a really good friend of mine. And, you know, we still keep in touch to this day. You know, our kids are friends and our wives are really good friends as well. But Ricky doesn't like me to talk about that very much.
Yeah, you bring up that story, and, you know, he was like, we're so close to a national championship. Yeah, definitely. So, Chad, then two more years, you guys, as I'm trying to remember. Isn't it funny? You know, I was a huge fan at that time, and I was younger then, and remembering completely, specifically those Colorado teams, the years you won the Big Eight, it's just you stumbled a couple times to never get that shot again in your junior and senior year. Am I correct?
You know, we lost, you know, the rest of the conference. We continued to win the conference, but other teams, you know, pulled ahead of us nationally. We stubbed our toe a couple of times. In college football, if you stub your toe at the wrong point of the season, it'll really come back to hurt you. You know, my senior year, we had a good year going. Then we went out to Nebraska and lost on a Halloween night. I think we lost like 45-3.
I remember that game still.
Yeah, that was, you know, we decided to put Coy Detmer in the game at quarterback. He was a young freshman, ended up being a very good player for Colorado and was a longtime backup in the NFL, but Coy just wasn't ready for what that Nebraska defense brought that night. And I think he's, like I said, threw five first half interceptions. It was an ugly night for the Buffalo. So, you know, stubbing your toe a couple of times in college football and your chances for a national championship are essentially gone. Okay, like I said, we won four consecutive Big Eight titles. I think in my 4 years there, I won something like 44 games or something. So, you know, a tremendous run. But yeah, the difference between winning a national championship and being somewhere in the top 10 or top 15 is really just one game in college football, and that razor's edge of sharpness and how you can try to maintain that for an entire season.
Definitely. So now you're ready to play in the NFL. And did you, when before the draft, did you have a team you wanted to play for? That's a good question to ask, Chet. Especially, you know, being from California. Did you have a, did you have any hopes of certain teams you wanted to play for going into the draft?
You know, it's so funny because, you know, there's certain, you know, obviously historic franchises like the Pittsburgh Steelers, like the Green Bay Packers. Before a kid, you know, coming up in California, you know, you don't want grow up wanting to be a Steeler. You don't want to grow up and be a Packer until you walk in those doors. You realize how special of a place it is to play, and it's such a historic place to play. So yeah, you know, you can't help but have, you know, as a 21-year-old guy, you know, thoughts of, you know, Miami, or at the time the Rams were still in L.A. So, you know, those were the thoughts going through your head. But there, you know, it's also the reality of football, what teams were good, what teams weren't, and what teams played the style of defense that you thought you would be good at. And then, you know, there's the other part of it is what teams are interested in you, what teams think you fit their system well. I flew out to meet with the Steelers before the draft, sat down and had dinner with Marvin Lewis. It was a great meeting. I really enjoyed Marv. But, you know, again, from a West Coast perspective, you know, Pittsburgh was a completely different slice of life than what I was accustomed to. But in the end, it ended up being, you know, a complete perfect fit. I doubt I would have been able to play as long as I did in the NFL if it hadn't been for those, you know, foundational years, those first couple years in Pittsburgh, really learning about pro football, having some great teammates, guys like Rod Woodson and Greg Lloyd, yes, and guys like that who kind of teach you the NFL game.
It, definitely, Chad, and having that experience of playing for the that storied franchise. When you play for the Steelers, you stay a Steeler forever, even though you played for all these other teams. I probably surprised you by pushing the whole Buffalo thing, but that's me. I march to a different beat of drum because that's one of my favorite teams too. But really, always a Steeler. When people probably see you down the street when you visit Pittsburgh, they just remember your days of the Steelers. And it's just truly, people in Pittsburgh live for this team. And I'd say that's probably about the Packers and a few other teams, that it's constantly been that day since the Rooneys, for sure. And that's the excitement of playing. And it's like almost like a college atmosphere, right, playing for the Steelers.
Well, you feel like you're part of, you know, football royalty. I was a Seahawk. I was also a Patriot. Patriots have obviously had a lot of success, but I think folks in that New England area don't necessarily grow up like kids in Pittsburgh grow up, where, you know, as a kid they wore Steeler bibs. You know, they slept on Steeler sheets. You know, every Christmas they got some kind of Steeler paraphernalia. So it's a different experience, I think, as far as being a Pittsburgh Steeler fan than, you know, I would say, outside of a couple other, you know, kind of iconic franchises than any other team. You know, the Jacksonville Jaguar fans or the Atlanta Falcon fans just don't have that same depth of love and the interwoven connection between the city and the team and the team and the city that the Pittsburgh Steelers have with the city of Pittsburgh. When I came back to the Steelers in 2006, in the 14th year of my career, I lived downtown in a little corporate apartment. So I would always walk around downtown, you know, just to kind of see what was going on or whatever, grabbing some groceries. And, you know, having left 10 years before to come back 10 years later and to see, you know, at every single bus stop, there's always somebody in Pittsburgh Steelers gear.
Yes.
You know, whether it's it could be a woman in an umbrella. It could be a guy in a Steelers sideline jacket. It could be an older guy in a sweatshirt or a hat. There's always somebody in Steeler gear. There's always somebody in Steeler merchandise. It's a fascinating connection. I think it's just, like I said earlier, just such a part of identity of the city that, very few other NFL teams could ever even hope to have that kind of connection with their fans.
Now, it's interesting because I interviewed LeVon Kirkland. I'm reminiscing and remembering things. It's funny how I'm able to do that. We look at the years that you went and played at Pittsburgh. Again, your last year, you had one more year, I think, right after the Super Bowl year. So you got to experience some huge success into one AFC championship game that you lost. That was the most disappointing thing in the world, to getting to the Super Bowl the following year. So those 2 years were unbelievable with the Steelers, weren't they? Because you really brought the Steelers back. I credit that 90s team for what 2000 did, in my opinion, meaning it brought back the Super Steelers, in my opinion. As growing up, I remember the 90s team very well.
Well, you know, it was a kind of a perfect storm for, you know, for me to go to Pittsburgh at, you know, a time when Dick LeBeau, Marvin Lewis, and Dom Capers and Bill Cowher are kind of, you know, really starting to, you know, focus and build up that zone blitz style of defense that was, you know, had a number of different roles that I could fill. To be able to go to the Pittsburgh Steelers at the same time that, you know, they bring in a Kevin Green. So I'm a pass rusher. I get to, you know, work on the other side of this guy and watch what he does all the time. I get a chance to play with Greg Lloyd. You know, in my mind, you know, with the baddest man in football at that time, really taught me and got me to understand the physical, intimidating nature of football and how that's really Steeler football. And that's the way we're going to play football here. So to come in as a rookie and have that guy teach me that was amazing. At the same time, you mentioned a guy, LeVon Kirkland. LeVon was just a year ahead of me. So we're both kind of soaking up this experience together and really growing together. And LeVon and I were inseparable in meetings and on the field. So, you know, it literally, you know, Marvin Lewis treated, you know, LeVon and I as one. You know, if one had to stay extra for something, then both of us had to stay extra. You know, Kevin and Greg were older guys. They got to go in and, you know, not stay after practice, but LeVon and I were out there with Marvin getting extra work done. So it was a really, you know, kind of a perfect storm of events, the coaching staff, you know, the players I got a chance to play with, and you know, some lucky breaks along the way. And yeah, to your point, we were able to kind of bring the Steelers back and develop some of that consistency, that consistent playoff team always competing for the Super Bowl kind of mindset back to the Steelers.
And it's never left since then, in my opinion, for sure. I mean, 8-8's it, and then they're back rolling again, winning again. So that's the nice thing. I mean, the day we don't see many 6-10, 4-12 years, and that's great. That would be kind of really boring in this city because this city would just shut down. But interesting when you talk about the linebackers you played with. Wow. I mean, just imagine a linebacking core like you guys. There's not many like this out there.
You know, I think that linebacker corps, according to NFL Films, was the seventh best linebacking group of all time. I think they had number one, that 70s group of Jack Ham and Lambert and those guys, was that earlier Steeler, you know, linebacker group. But the style of defense, the 3-4 style of defense, particularly that zone blitz, you know, was really a linebacker-centric defense. And there's been, you know, once Kevin left, and Jason Gildon steps up and he fills that role. You know, so they've always got, you know, guys coming in, you know, a Joey Porter over the last couple of years, a James Harrison. So there's always guys who can be featured in that defense and really, you know, take advantage of that and play some, you know, dominating physical defense in that style. And I was, you know, very happy to be a part of that group. Like I said, if I hadn't come in to the Steelers at that time with that group, I doubt I would have been able to play 15 years. But those guys taught me the work ethic, the, you know, the intensity, the physical nature, all that kind of stuff you need to last for a long time in the NFL.
So after that, Chad, you leave the Steelers as a free agent and go play for the Seattle Seahawks. And people don't remember that because, again, the Seahawks weren't that good at that time. And you had 2 Pro Bowls you earned. So you continued to play at a high level, but you kind of disappeared in a way. Kind of like it's funny. I was talking to Norm Johnson about, you know, he went first the Seahawks. I always consider him a Steeler, but you know, it's funny when you leave our team, we'll cheer, we won't cheer for you, but we'll always consider the respect that, hey, you're a Steeler regardless. But your days of the Seahawks, so you still played at a pretty high level, and you got the end of your career with the Patriots. Did you guys win the year you played for the Patriots? I don't remember that. for sure.
No, no. It's, you know, the funny, it's, life's always so funny sometimes. I left the Seahawks in 04, ended up playing with the Patriots in 05. Well, in 05, I visited the Pittsburgh Steelers during the free agent times. I visited New England. And I live here in Denver. I spoke a lot to the Denver Broncos, and I had a chance to return back to the Seattle Seahawks. You know, it's funny. I go to New England. They had just come off of back-to-back Super Bowls. We end up losing to Denver in the playoffs here in Denver. The Steelers end up beating Denver in the championship game, and then they play the Seahawks in the Super Bowl and beat the Seahawks. So it's just kind of funny how life works out sometimes. You know, I had a choice to go to, like I said, all four of those teams. Unfortunately, you know, I suppose I chose wrong, although I really enjoyed my experience in New England. Bill Belichick is just such an amazing coach, and I learned a tremendous amount while I was there. But yeah, that's, I missed that Super Bowl in 2005 just because, you know, I wanted to be a Patriot instead of being a Steeler.
But so, and as I look at this, you went back to the Steelers again. So you really played for some storied franchises. I can't believe you say the Seahawks are now because of where they are today. So you could say, hey, I played for winners. And it's nice to say, especially in your career and in college. So you knew about winning. So your career ends in football. What's life after football? Do you keep winning, Chad? That's the important thing in the game of life.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I've been so incredibly lucky, you know, my entire playing career, going back to Pop Warner, when championships in Pop Warner, my high school team in California, we won 32 games in a row, back-to-back, you know, championships as well there, national championship in Colorado, you know, played for the Steelers, played for the Patriots, played for the, you know, the Seahawks. And I was part of that 2007 Patriots team that was, you know, the almost perfect season, ended up losing in the Super Bowl to the Giants. So lots of winning. And, you know, at the same time, when you retire football, life's not over. You still got to go out there and, to your point, win some more. And that's what, you know, I try to do. I try to take the discipline and the lessons of the game off the field and apply them, you know, to my life now. And hopefully for the next 45 years, I'll be working these football lessons into real life.
That's tremendous. And now, what are you currently doing, Chad?
Well, I've got a couple of companies that I run here in Colorado. I've got a shipping company. We have a couple of different branches of it right now. Ship Your Reptiles is one of our websites, and Ship Your Aquatics. We specialize in shipping things that you can't really show up at a, you know, FedEx Kinko's and say, here, I want to ship this fish or this snake to my friends. So we facilitate animal shipping for hobbyists and business all over the U.S. Most weeks we do, you know, somewhere between 500 and 750 next day airs a week for customers, you know, whether, again, they're hobbyists or there's someone just relocating and moving across the country to get their animals across the country, or for breeding businesses both in the aquatics and the reptile world. It's a fun job, keeps us on our toes. It's a pretty intense thing, particularly when we have bad weather like we're having right now, where, you know, shipments are delayed and, you know, folks need their animals. So it's a lot of fun, and like I said, I always take the lessons of the field and try to put them into action at the business.
And are you doing anything else, some commentating and stuff, or some media work? Somehow it said in Wikipedia you did that before. Have you done some...
Yes. Well, you know, like every retired football player, you know, you can't help but, you know, somebody puts a microphone in your face, you end up talking to them.
Well, you're really, you're very good. So that's why I said, definitely.
You know, I would say I've been at this about 3 years now, and I started off as a very, you know, even as a kid, I was a quiet, shy person, and I saw the media opportunities as a chance to kind of get some personal growth going and, you know, kind of grow up a little bit. I figured if I want to get into coaching, if I can talk better, I'd be a better coach. You know, my business, the better communicator I can be, the better business owner I can be, the better parent I can be. You know,
yes.
So I really embraced this opportunity to, you know, become a little bit more of a media personality. And I've had a lot of fun with it and some success. This last year I called some games for ESPN3, I do a lot of games for Westwood One Radio, the national radio feed for some college football and some NFL football. Lots of local Bronco stuff here in Denver, and I'm on the radio pretty much every day as well. So, yeah, it's a full, you know, life doing the shipping, doing your media stuff, and, you know, dad, husband, and, you know, dog owner as well.
You know, it's interesting, Chad, when you said this, because I could tell you're well-trained. An easy interview. When you interview somebody that's always on, does interviews others, is in the media, it's like, oh, this is a cakewalk for us, and we could have a great conversation. I know it. And I was a shy kid too growing up, so it's very interesting how we kind of figure out our niches later in life and are more comfortable speaking in front of people. But now I've only done a few talks in front of people, but now because I've done so much radio and TV, I'm comfortable, and I say, hey, give me 3,000 people to talk to, because I was a teacher as well, Chad. So it's like, bring it on. But it's amazing how we get our life experiences, for sure. So you, I remember always the reptiles with you, with the Steelers. You had a lot of them. How many do you have now in your house?
Well, you know, we had a fire in late 2011, and we lost the entire snake collection in the fire. We lost about 3,000 reptiles in the fire. There was also several hundred eggs still in the incubator to hatch that year. It was a crushing blow, really. For 20 years, I built that business, and once I retired in 2007, I was really able to move the business forward. We were producing thousands of animals a year, shipping and selling animals all over the world. Like I said, having a tremendous amount of success. But that fire ended that. And as heartbreaking as it was to not rebuild the business, my partner and I decided that would be best, and for us to really focus on some of these other things that we do. I talked about the shipping company. Yes. We also have some companies that, you know, sell products in the reptile world and design products for the reptile and the pet world. We've also got another company that's essentially like a reptile or an online reptile newspaper and a classified site. So the Reptile Report is that website, reptilereport.com, and also the Reptile Report Marketplace is our classified site for, you know, buying, selling, trading reptiles. And we are going to continue to replicate these concepts and other animal hobbies as time goes on. So yeah, we were still involved in that reptile world, just no longer as breeders of reptiles, no longer physically, you know, keeping thousands of reptiles at our facility anymore. Sad day, you know, bad day, really kind of ended that phase of my life, unfortunately. But as football has taught me, phases of your life are going to end, and you got to be able to move forward. Yes. So while I can no longer play football, I can certainly be on television or radio talking about football or coaching football or, you know, doing those kind of things. And while I no longer breed reptiles here myself, I can help others who breed reptiles get them safely to their customers. I can help them advertise their animals, talk about their animals, sell their animals, and all those other things. So I'm still involved in the hobby, but just in a slightly different way.
Do you own any of your own, or you stopped at that too? Because that was
what... Yeah, I've got a gecko that I've had for 20 years that actually is in a cage in my workout room. I've had this gecko for forever. And right now in my office, I've got one lizard. It's kind of an oddball, kind of rare lizard from Cuba. They're called false chameleons. Kind of looks like a more traditional chameleon, but it's not actually a chameleon. So it's not something you would see in most pet stores, kind of a more unusual animal. And then I've also got a 500-gallon fish tank here in my office that I'm looking at right now.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, I'm turning into a slice of the Amazon currently.
All right. Well, it's great talking to you, Chad. Best place we can find information on you. Have a bunch of different websites. I call you an entrepreneur and the media guy. That's kind of me, but not to the scale of Chad Brown. But I hope to someday, entrepreneur-wise, be to the scale of Chad Brown. So I continue to work hard to build my tutoring consulting business, and I do some social media and branding for companies. So it's awesome to talk to somebody that took life after football and is success off the field as well as he was successful on the field, Chad, for sure.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And where can we find best info for you? Is it to go?
Okay, so you can find me on Twitter at ChadBrown94. And again, you can check out the Reptile Report at thereptilereport.com. Our classified site is the reptilereportmarketplace.com. And if you got some shipping needs, shipyourreptiles.com or shipyouraquatics.com.
You're a busy guy. You really are,
Jim. I am.
That's good. That's good. And that's because you're used to the training when you were in sports. I talked to one other person I think as busy as you. Bill Cartwright is a busy man and the former NBA star. He works as hard as you do, for sure. He's constantly doing tons of stuff. And that's good because you guys see you want to be successful in the entrepreneur field as much as you were on the football field or basketball court. Well, so good talking.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And the same lessons apply. You know, hard work, you know, getting after it, being harder working and better prepared than the next person. You know, that applies in football or basketball or, in this case, you know, business.
Exactly. Good talking, Chad. Thanks again.
All right, take it easy. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You're listening to the Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment.